and saw the note. I only got a notice it didn't give the authors of these books at all. This book is by a man called Thomas Pynchon, P-Y-N-C-H-O-N, and it's called The Crime of Lot 49, and I've chosen it for the simple reason that it seems to me a contemporary novel, rather than a sort of early 20th century one. I take it that modern means now. This man, Pynchon, has written a couple of novels and three short stories. He's a major figure in the contemporary American scene. Apart from that, you might ask, well, why put him in a course like this? The answer is, I think that what I want to show you is that he raises problems about criticism, about novel structure, which are pretty contemporary to my mind. The problem immediately then rises, as anybody who knows anything about contemporary literature, rather than what passes as criticism knows, is that, in fact, you have to know quite a bit about science and philosophy to understand where you are, which means, like, you have to know things that happened in 1890. It's also part of an exploration in contemporary America, a very serious explanation of what law and order, in fact, are. So let me put some of this into an American context. I know some of you here are American study students who are working with me and other people. Now, practical law and order, outlawry, and a possible return to aboriginal barbarism haunts American culture from at least the time of Washington Irving and the early Republic onwards. Once the Republic starts to be culturally self-conscious, there is a parallel activity that is towards feeling that there might be a rundown towards what are very roughly called frontier conditions. This discussion of order and disorder receives full dramatic treatment continually in American literature. I think one of the best places to take, and I know some of you know it, is Letter 9 of Krabker's Letters from an American Farmer, 1782. I mean the point where a dying caged Negro demonstrates the end of the 18th century drama of egalitarian liberal society. It has not yet reappeared in the New World, or anywhere else as far as I can see. And from 1782, one can move forward very quickly to 1906 and see Henry Adams describing the vision of modern men's condition as he saw it, as I quote, a void of shapeless energies with resistless mass, colliding, crushing, and wasting and destroying what these same energies had created, labored, and labored from eternity to perfect. And he decides that goodness was order, law, unity, evil was disorder, anarchy, multiplicity. And he asks, which is the truth? The urge to order for the purposes of control is a constant danger. For human purposes, a point must always soon be reached when larger synthesis is suicide. But from the history of science, Adams in 1906, who was an up-to-date man, he learns that, I quote, chaos was the law of nature. Order was the dream of man, by which he means the facts of entropy. That is, the formulas about the loss of heat in energy laid down by the second law of thermodynamics. That is, the second law seems to oppose human urge to order, which is built in. Now, I quote here from a book on the second law by a couple of scientists. The general and universal trend of entropy increase easily swamps the anomalous but important efforts of civilized man. Each localized man-made or machine-made entropy decrease is accompanied by a greater increase in entropy of the surroundings, thereby maintaining the required increase in total entropy. This is called Order and Chaos, Laws of Energy and Entropy by Angrist and Hepler, 1967. This is very roughly the theory of the decrease of energy in any system, the universe or your own body. Now, the next thing I want to say is that, of course, this kind of, what in fact is the vitality system that keeps this order going is very central for novelists in the 20th century. In Norman Mailer's advertisements for myself, he lists, in fact, some of the well-known devices or semantic devices for talking about this. Energy, life, sex, force, the yoga's prana, the Reichian's orgone, Lawrence's blood, Hemingway's good, the Shavian life force, and so on and so on. There are many of these. They're all part of the same, what is called negative catalyst. That is, something which maintains the structure of the human in an unstable, universal, and national condition. That is, something which delays the law of increasing entropy and causes the organism to escape immediate disintegration, which it's going towards anyway. But the trend towards maximum disorder can only be slowed down in that way, for a period of time, as they say, exactly equal to a lifetime. Perpetual motion machines, although a constant desire of the human mind, have never been built. And the sun, as they say, goes on cooling. Now, communications can be considered, and the crying of Lot 49 of Thomas Pynchon is about communications. Communications are only a way of preventing a rapid chaos of relationships between individuals. Although today, and this is again one of Pynchon's main points, they appear to threaten order by overcomplexity and are therefore in themselves entropic. Let me quote a passage from one of these books. I won't give you all these names. If anybody's concerned, they can easily contact me. Maybe technological explosion means psychological implosion. Communications theorists talk excitedly about the electric dilation of our senses and the global village. At what point does a global village become a controlled environment? Our extensions multiply, weave a web around us, send back images of impotence. America seems more and more a controlled environment, a closed sphere. Frustration, finding no escape valves, feeds on itself and on media representations of itself. Now, Thomas Pynchon's novel and the short story he wrote called Entropy, which you can find in a magazine called Noble Savage, number 3, these are corrections of manic communications interaction and the web of electronically externalized nervous systems described as inevitable fact by Marshall McLuhan. In fact, one way of reading it, if you know McLuhan's work, is to read this book as a correction of it. Pynchon draws the hypotheses of science into a commentary on society, understanding that it is not a question of metaphors. We're not talking about metaphors at all. We're not talking about metaphors from one field into another, because there's a single field. It's a question of understanding the whole of that. That is, the science and society, single field of energy in action. But, like quite a number of contemporary novelists, and certainly in America, Norman Mailer and William Burroughs, and other major figures of that critical kind, Pynchon entertains very strongly the possibility that energy runs towards disastrous expenditure and sacrifice at an increasing rate which can't be prevented. Now, the crying of Lot 49 is plotted through the theory of entropy. That is, in order to observe animate and inanimate activity in a single field. The second law of thermodynamics, it formulates the loss of heat in any system, as I said, any particular part of the universe. And Pynchon uses this structure to structure relationships between human exertions of energy within society and the energy activity of larger universal systems, for instance, ideologies. His concern is generally with the possibility of, on the one hand, entropic stasis, that is, total overcomplexity, which moves towards the completely static and therefore dead, and the possibility of change. Therefore, it concerns us very strongly, does it not? There might be, he considers, particularly in his short story Entropy, but it's present here in the crying of Lot 49 too, that there might be an equalization of the loss in men and in the universe into a stabilized chaos. How long this will take, the second law doesn't say. And I quote from this book on the second law I've been talking about: man creates local and temporary islands of decreasing entropy in a world in which entropy as a whole certainly increases. And it is the existence of these islands that enables some of us to assert the existence of progress. Entropy can only be decreased temporarily, and then only in a localized region, at the expense of a greater increase elsewhere. And in his work, and particularly in this book and the short story I mentioned, Pynchon refers both to Henry Adams and to a key book of our time, Norbert Wiener's The Human Use of Human Beings. which is about cybernetics and entropy. Wiener's book speculates on the meanings of entropy for human behavior. That is, the movement towards the fusion of social entropy and cosmic entropy, that is, deathly immobility. The point is that all closed systems tend to deteriorate. They lose their distinctiveness, and Pynchon's apprehension is that America moves that way steadily towards over-organized society of chaos. Now, for Norbert Wiener, progress depends on, quite simply, enclaves, I'm quoting, of increasing organization. But, of course, immediately the irony is that those enclaves tend to fuse to the point where you have an overloaded system, and overloaded systems lose their energy rapidly. So the scientist and the artist are always working, Wiener says, to discover the order and organization of the universe, and are thus playing a game against the arch enemy, disorganization. Now, the plot of The Crying of Lot 49 is a warning game about communications theory and the urge of human beings to discover rigid orders and merge with them. Now, already in his other novel, V, which is in The Penguin, which came out in 63, already in that huge structure, Pynchon had constructed a plot of metamorphoses of the life principle. The capital V of the title stands for a number of these. The life principle in a variety of forms, not all of them, those which Mailer lists, but they include his. And he refers to, and I quote from the book, the ultimate plot, and he capitalizes the next five words, the ultimate plot which has no name, was as yet unrealized, though V might be no more than a sailing vessel or a notion. That is, the plot exists all the time, everywhere, in everything. There are no metaphors. The writer himself may be inventing an order, which is what Wallace Stevens calls a supreme fiction. But as anybody who knows Wallace Stevens' work realizes that the point of Stevens' poetry is that that is all there is, a supreme fiction. And you work towards it, you don't discover it. And it can take any form. Now, the plots of novels, then, as you must know by now, are always the visions of order against entropy, which the writer tries to support. In chapter 11 of V, one of the two heroes, this novel has two heroes, is a man called Stencil. And he reads the confessions of one of the major characters. A man, Pynchon's very fond of giving people indicative names like Fielding or Dickens or Ben Jonson. Fausto Maestral is this man's name. Well, I went out of lies, that's not what. Take hours. These confessions of this major character, Fausto Maestral, include Pynchon's own preoccupations with plot. That's why I want to quote them here. It's a confession within a confession, read by an invented character in search of meaning. We can justify any apologia simply by calling life a successive rejection of personalities. No apologia is any more than a romance, half a fiction, in which all the successive identities taken on and rejected by the writer as a function of linear time are treated as separate characters. The writing itself even constitutes another rejection, another character added to the past. So we sell our souls, paying them away to history in little installments. It is not so much to pay for eyes clear enough to see past the fiction of continuity, the fiction of humanized history endowed with, quote, reason, unquote. That is a total demolition, of course, by contemporary and philosophical and scientific standards of that kind of rubbish which suggests there's a single plot and there is a reason in it. Elsewhere in the book, Fausto speaks of history entropically as, I quote, the work of inanimating organizations towards final equilibrium. Again, a chaos of total communication, which reduces men to the condition of grotesques. That is, people who believe in religion and history rather than physics. I quote, finally subject to the laws of physics, all the time pretending it was a great struggle between the laws of man and the laws of God. And he goes on to say, random cellular conjunctions can be made into fiction, but this is, I quote, a way of compensating for an inability to live with the truth. That is, the second law, matter, cells, and also any alien mechanical growth, as he says, which at some point seems to have acquired a soul. The same forces which dictate the bomb's trajectory, the deaths of stars, the wind, and the water spout, have focused somewhere inside the pelvic frontiers without their consent to generate one more mighty accident. It frightens them to death. It would frighten anyone. And V therefore ends with death in a water spout. This is a nice way to die, as they say. Pynchon then is warning here against becoming inanimate or the subject of the animate. That is, to be part of a system which is running down, and all systems run down. And as Norbert Wiener says, there are no guarantees. Metaphor, then, in this kind of structure, has no value except as a function. It's a device, an artifice. The universe in this book is, I quote, innate mindlessness, and not to be, and I quote again, cloaked with comfortable and pious metaphor so that the practical half of humanity may continue in the great lie. Confident that their machines, dwellings, streets, and weather share the same human motives, personal traits, and fits of contrariness as they do. Poets, he says, have functioned in the past as perpetuators of the lie, and it still seems to be the role of the poet in the 20th century to lie. And this character in the book, Fausto, returns to his role as the artist, that is, the liar, but also in a spirit of understanding and anti-entropic despair. The basic image of V, I may say, is a version of the old fortune's wheel thing in medieval literature, but it's horizontal, so that the only charm you get of it is stroboscopic light coming off the spokes as they go around. Which figures? Direction could change, but the hub still held the spokes in place, and the meeting place of the spokes still defined the hub. And he ends the book, short of examining the entire history of each individual participating, short of anatomizing each soul, what hope has anyone of understanding a situation, capital S? It may be that the civil servants of the future will not be accredited unless they first receive a degree in brain surgery. So the human quest in a human universe begins neurally, in inner space. And all these characters, you could call Stencil, which is a good name for them, pursue their dreams of single binding myth of myths. But as their name implies, their action consists of transfer printing, and no more. Now, Pynchon's V, then, is a large-scale dramatization of the whole situation, which necessarily includes the nature of the situation, a criticism of the situation, and the person's writing about the situation. But it is not a Faustian urge to write myths. It has considerable more modesty. Now, the crying of Lot 49 proposes that the quest for meaning an order may take place, unknown to the seeker, within a closed circuit, and therefore reinforce chaos of over-order and over-communication, that chaos of multiple synthesis which Henry Adams feared in 1906. And remember another character in a contemporary American novel first. I expect some of you have read Joseph Heller's novel Cash 22, where the hero there in 1961 has a vision of, I quote, a whole world boiling in chaos in which everything was in proper order. It was a classic entropic statement. And the book is about just that. The heroine of Pynchon's Crying of Lot 49 has a vision of the Southern Californian town where she lives, called San Narciso, as a printed circuit in a transistor radio. Which is quite easy if you look down on the town and you feel that way. Self-sufficient, sterile, generating energy at the mercy of input, and endlessly reproducible, inanimate, impersonal, and a parody of the myth of communication systems as human systems. As they say, invention may well be the mother of necessity. Her character, and I refuse to analyze this in the time I've got, her name is Mrs. Oedipa Mars, MAAS, by the way. She's left a legacy which involves her in the deciphering of the symbol of an ancient and international communication system whose signs she observes throughout her environment. It's a muted post horn. A sign with all the allure, you'll notice, of music, communications, and resistant movement symbolism. A real invitation to the symbol bugs among us, as you well know. And she is a symbol bug. Which is what's gone wrong with her. Her quest takes place in the man-made wasteland of Southern California, in which the inanimate impinges on the inanimate, on the animate, rather, at every point, and the media on the living. And Pynchon's business is to reveal organizations which seem to be in revolt against each other in a model of power conflicts, which are the substance of history itself, of course. But the resistance movement itself is sinister, fascistic, and hierarchical. The secret society, in fact, he is saying, may resist established power order, but all organizations affect those who believe their talents to be exhausted by other systems. And this organization is called, and I quote, the capitals, with full stops between them, WASTE. So this, which I shall call WASTE for short. WASTE is the type of the organization which appears to be anti-entropic, but is in fact part of the sacrifice of human energy to a system. The very name should make, of course, the half-addict, or the whole addict to systems, very wary. But Oedipa Mars desires to penetrate secret order. She's one of those. That is the totally unselfconsciously vicious. So the town, therefore, appears to her as, I quote, a hieroglyph sense of concealed meaning, of an intent to communicate. There'd seem no limit to what the printed circuit could have told her, in brackets, if she had tried to find out. At first, she only senses the narcissism, as if on some other frequency or out of the eye of some whirlwind, rotating too slow for her heated skin even to feel the centrifugal coolness of, words were being spoken. This is called in the book The Religious Instant. It's an intuition of order and meaning to which she will finally yield. She will finally end up the sacrificial victim of her husband's plan, into which her psychic inclination entices her. I think Pynchon's a bit unfair there. One feels it's her education as well as her psychic intuition that has enticed her. But he doesn't say anything about that, which is a fault of my man. So the electronic web of the McLuhanites may well be theology. And I should remind you that McLuhan is a Catholic, so it's hardly surprising that he's interested in communication systems, and particularly over-organized ones. That is the mystical dogma, which is the sacrificial system. Now, Oedipa, then, is hooked on order, and therefore she is at the mercy of anyone who plays her need to make it into what William Burroughs has defined as the very face of evil, that is, total need. The postal communication system running throughout history is called the Tristero system, T-R-I-S-T-E-R-O. And the Tristero system is an ancient and surviving conspiracy to set up and maintain an unofficial and apparently anarchistic communication system to counter the official state mails. And it begins in Flanders in 16th century, if I remember. The major clue in San Narciso in Southern California is a clever and amusing parody of a Jacobean drama put on by a local company and called the Curious Tragedy. The key exegetical line, as the buffs have it, is, "And tacit lies the gold once knotted horn." And they go half balmy in the book, analysing it, as you probably have experienced as well in your lectures. Oedipa gradually moves into the imprisonment of her detective search. That is, she's a sort of 19th century detective heroine, like Freud or Darwin or one of Dostoevsky's, or Sherlock Holmes, or one of these curious characters of 19th century literature. And her detective search and imprisonment is itself a parody of the mainstream of the 19th century novel, which imitates the discovery of meaning, as if you could discover it. And of course, you can line this up, if you're interested in the novel at all in our own time, with the figures like Alain Robbe-Grillet and a man, a theorist like Roland Barthes, the structuralist in France, who are doing a very similar thing, criticizing the fallacy of fiction making along these detective revealing lines. Now, Oedipus, throughout the book, makes deductions on hypotheses without touching or smelling or seeing the human energy which constructs the system. And the brilliant inventiveness of the book is a parody of false information, falsely juxtaposed, and interlocked to provide the illusion of necessity. It's therefore a parody, as I said, of Darwinism, Marxism, Freudianism, and any other system posing as organizational answer based on detective work in the history of men and the universe. Now, to come back to that thing that I had to say at the beginning, I hope it didn't confuse you too much about entropy. Since 1900, I'm thinking about 1890 to about 1912, I suppose, something like that, science and philosophy have destroyed the grounds for any such arrogance of absolutism, that you can discover anything of the truth which is absolute. Absolute truth has been replaced by the second law, and the uncertainty principle, the theory of relativity, and the impossibility of asserting more than multiple descriptions of changing events. So that the hero as invader, tourist, explorer, spy, detective, and agent can only now be used as an actor in a plot of discovery and meaning, which is open-ended, and probably parodies him. In fact, the point is then that knowledge increases, and is in increasing acceleration, and this increase is brought to bear in such a way that the system can only possibly be hypothesis. And the more knowledge, the more human involvement, and the less objectivity. This is standard philosophical, psychological, and physics practice, of course. Now, Oedipus Mars, then, is the type of the analyst whose person and instruments of understanding become increasingly parts of the process of discovery and what is discovered. The entropic tendency to the degeneration of energy is the system, and it's typically called waste, which the analyst explores, and as she explores, increases. The novel closes down at the point where the heroine is entirely within the closed system. She attends an auction sale of postage stamps, which is the signs of communication, and the sale room is the meeting place of the Tristera organization. The novel doesn't close down on itself, because it can't on these circumstances, so one's left with the feeling either she's completely paranoid, or there really is a system. But considering that the book is from her point of view, we just don't know. I quote, either Oedipus in the orbiting ecstasy of a true paranoia, or a real Tristera. For there either was some Tristera beyond the appearance of the legacy America, or there was just America. And if it was just America, then it seemed the only way she could continue and manage to be at all relevant to it was as an alien, unfurrowed, assuming full circle into some paranoia. So within the oldest building, within this transistor circuit called San Narciso, the organization begins to absorb her entirely. I quote, an assistant closed the heavy door of the lobby windows and the sun. She heard the lock snap shut. The sound echoed a moment. The auctioneer spread his arms in a gesture that seemed to belong to the priesthood of some remote culture, perhaps to a descending angel. The auctioneer cleared his throat. Oedipus settled back to await the crying of Lot 49. Earlier in the book, she's entered into her notebook, a phrase which I'll use later on as well. She writes down, she keeps notebook of all these events, and she writes down at one point, shall I project a world? And she does so. And the result is this imitation of the action of theology, science, and philosophy in its 19th century forms, particularly. Oedipus wishes to be disposed of by the inanimate. Visiting Mexico City with her future husband, this is in a flashback, before she's married, and she remembers this. Her husband is, by the way, called Pierce Inverarity. That name suggests, in fact, I must say a bit about this. The name suggests exactly what his function in the book is. He's to be a sort of rare and perverse penetration of invariable verities. And in Mexico City, she sees a painting of girls imprisoned in a circular tower, like ladies of Shalott, in fact. That's his image, not mine. And she weeps as she recognizes her own condition. Quote, that what really kept her where she is magic, anonymous and malignant, visited on her from outside and for no reason at all. But her life turned out to be only a search for the waste organization of that magic, and therefore another tower. I quote, having no apparatus except gut fear and female cunning to examine this formless magic, to understand how it works, how to measure its field strength, count its lines of force, she may fall back on superstition or take up a useful hobby like embroidery. Or go mad, or marry a disc jockey. Which in fact does, by the way, in the book. If the tower is everywhere, and the knights of deliverance no proof against its magic, what else? Of course, that's a direct reference to Tennyson's marvellous poem. Now, Edith Piaf, then, is in the midst of the history of the bourgeois novel. From Moll Flanders right through to Clarissa, Anna Karenina, and Dorothy O'Brooke, and Lady Chatterley. That is, heroines whom male novelists keep triangulating by the cash, class, sex triangulation. In a male-dominated world, in order to discover the nature of victimization. But the woman is the instance of the vulnerable sensibility in the world of waste systems, and stands for every man or woman who thinks at all about organization and feels involved in it. Now, Pierce Inverarity owned this transistor city, it turns out, including its aerospace industrial plant, through which the web of technological power will entrap outer space as well as San Narciso. So San Narciso shows forth an unseen organizer, and it's Oedipus' husband. And he is the descendant of all those tycoons in Dreiser, and the type of those power men for whom Herman Kahn today writes his scenarios for the future. One of the counterforces is, I can't talk about the whole of this book, it's quite short, but it's rather complicated in its the character relationships. It's not difficult, it's complex, it's something else. One of the characters I want to talk about is the counterforce represented by a figure called Jesus Arabal. And he belongs to an organization called CIA, but the initials stand for Conjuración de los Insurgentes Anarquistas, which is exactly in the center of the book, in fact. Like, you just don't know. you know, you may think the CIA are right or wrong, but supposing another one comes up with the same initials, what about them? Which is nice. So the point being that there's another organization then dedicated not to, in this case, magic power of stasis, but magic power of change. He believes in miracles of change. That's his word. Now, as I was saying just now, change takes place within entropy only as a temporary island of temporary resistance. And it's like dear old William Empson says, the waste remains and kills. Jesus says to Oedipus, you know what a miracle is, not what Bakunin said, but another world's intrusion into this one. Most of the time we coexist peacefully, but when we do touch, there's cataclysm. Like the church we hate, anarchists also believe in another world, where revolutions break out spontaneous and leaderless, and the soul's talent for consensus allows the masses to work together without effort. Automatic as the body itself. And yet, if any of it should really happen that perfectly, I would also have to cry miracle, an anarchistic miracle, like your friend, he means Pierce Inverarity, who is too exactly and without flaw the thing we fight. Now, the anarchist dilemma is notoriously that it seeks stability between the rigidity of order and the chaos of total individualism. Arabal's enemy is the visionary of total need. But his total opposition to it tends to be as entropic as any kind of system. I quote, "The trouble with organization is it's just like perfection. The more you have, the more you want." Now, Oedipa then fails to perceive the life which that advice implies. She marries a disc jockey, it's her second husband, a man imprisoned in another kind of town, it's called the entertainment industry. He's a performer in the main communications control of American behavior. And he leaves that, and his second job is for another beautiful communications industry called the car industry. Another instance of addiction to the inanimate. I quote, "He could never, it's a second-hand car industry, which is even worse." No, it's not. It's the new car industry is the worst. "He could still never accept the way each owner, each shadow, filed in only to exchange a dented, malfunctioning version of himself for another. Just as futurist, automotive projection of someone else's life, as if it were the most natural thing, Oedipa couldn't understand how he could still get so upset even now." She's also got a psychotherapist, like so many other characters in contemporary American fiction, and he's appropriately, at least I think appropriately, called Dr. Hilarium. And he experiments, what he's up to at the moment is experimenting with the effects of drugs on suburban housewives, who permit themselves to be used as instruments for science, quote unquote. That is, they are quite expendable, she is, and they seem to like it. Now notice the image from heroin here, because the idea of addiction is central in this book, as it is in William Burroughs. I mean, you can be addicted to anything, motor cars, aspirin, TV, you know, anything you like. So the heroin can be a metaphor, an instance rather, I'm sorry, an instance for the whole lot. Were Oedipa some single melted crystal of urban horse, Los Angeles really would be no less turned on for her absence. That is, the addictive society continues, and she begins to perceive it as a plot. I quote, "an elaborate seduction." When she, for instance, I'm giving you one of the examples here. When she sees a map of one of Pierce Inverarity's interests, which is called the Fangoso Lagoons Estate, flashed on a TV screen in an advert, she recalls an earlier experience. Some immediacy was there again, some promise of hierophanty, printed circuit, gently curving street, private access to the water, the Book of the Dead. Now, everywhere she looks then becomes a book of revelations and rituals, sacred mysteries, esoteric principles, and their priests. Her temporary affair with a lawyer called Metzger, I'll look it up for the German meanings. One of the meanings is butcher. Her co-executor, by the way, in the legacy, an ex-child movie star who was addicted to his own early movies. Their affair ends in a marvelous farce of communications and physics, a love affair told like that. At the climax of it, a hairspray bounces around as its liquid, atomizing under pressure, performs some kind of manic demonstration of Willard Gibbs's rule of phase, by which, you remember, solids become liquids and liquids become gases. The can knew where it was going, she sensed, or something fast enough. God or digital machine, it might have computed in advance the complex web of its travel. And immediately following that, their orgasm is a parody of sex told at electronic communications, which is a stab at the Reichians and all that kind of circuitry. At the climax of it, the lights go out owing to the system of electricity in the building being overloaded by a pop group called the Paranoids. And her climax and Metzger's coincide with all the lights going out in the place, including the TV tube, which they've been looking at as they're at it. Including the TV tube, suddenly going out, dead, black. It was a curious experience. The Paranoids had blown the fuse. Metzger proves, as you can imagine, nearly useless. So Oedipa enters the detection system alone after this point. This is about two-thirds way through the book. She discovers that one of the people she's in contact with is called Tony Jaguar, who's an important figure in Cosa Nostra. The point here being that the mafia must be placed inside any novel dealing with American entropic society, otherwise it isn't accurate. Now, the Tony Jaguar, through the Cosa Nostra, supplies bones to Pierce Inverarity, who owns a 51% interest in a bone charcoal filter for cigarettes. The bones are obtained from the Lago di Pietà, which is an Italian scene of battle between American and German soldiers in 1943. The bones are therefore an instance of sacrifice to what Burroughs calls a world, I quote, insane with purpose. That is, the consumers consume their dead ancestral consumers. And the plot resembles that of the Curious Tragedy, the Jacobean fake play, bones of lost battalions in lake fished up, turned into charcoal. Oedipus sees the play, The Curious Tragedy, in the production by a group called the Tank Players, but she is not warned by its obvious resemblance to her own situation. It's a bloodthirsty play on characteristic power subjects of 17th century drama and all those grotesques. Usurpation is its basic theme, which is the basic theme in Shakespeare, and the basic theme in a great number of Jacobean plays. In this case, the theme is the taking over of the postal monopoly of the Turn and Taxis family during the Holy Roman Empire. The action relates to the continuing action of the Tristera system. All the clues are very complex, and the director of the play, with a delightful name of Driblet, suggests that Oedipa, I quote, could waste, he says to her, you could waste your life that way and never touch the truth. That is, you go on analysing these darn plays and never get near them. Oedipa ignores this advice. I quote, under the symbol of the muted knotted horn, she'd copied off the latrine wall of the Scope, which is an electronic people's cafe hangout, into her memo book. She wrote, shall I project a world? If not project, then at least flash some arrow on the dome to skitter among constellations and trace out your dragon, whale, southern cross, anything might help. No prizes for those references. Now, unlike Driblet, though, she wants much more than a functional metaphor of the situation. She wants the secret meaning. A scientist appears at this point called Stanley Kotex, who begins to explain Clark Maxwell's demonstration of the second law to her, which I won't go into. The main thing, it turns out, that he too is part of the organization, part of the counter-organization, which is also part of the organization. That is, this is an image of the exploitation of science by these big concerns. And Oedipa at least understands the ambiguity of her quest at this point, which is very near the end of the book. I quote, the act of metaphor, then, was a thrust at truth and a lie, depending where you were. Inside, safe, or outside, lost. Oedipa didn't know where she was. Then she moves through a number of instances which have to be interpreted as truth or lie. But her bent is towards infallibility. There's a whole series of these instances to do with postal systems, including the Wells Fargo, the Pony Express, a marvellous philatelist called Genghis Cohen, who shows her a 1940 United States stamp commemorating the Pony Express, which has the waste symbol in its watermark, and therefore is part of their organisation and so on. You can imagine the kind of thing it is. Oedipa seems to come near to resolutions of all this, but one by one her informants start to disappear, like those who knew about Kennedy's murder, you remember. I think the analogy is very important. Some commit suicide, some are murdered. Unknown to herself, this is the point, she is becoming the sole container of their information, and therefore of their deaths. She pieces the information together from the 16th century to the present day, and the result is a pattern of disinheritance and usurpation of human energies told as a challenge to postal monopoly, itself the analogue of all communication systems. To regain inheritance, Tristero has been waging, I quote, a campaign of obstruction, terror, and depredation. And it's their organisation, among others, that Oedipa is entering. Pynchon shows the completeness of her fate in ways which suggest that it isn't just educational in this case, but his bias, as I say, is towards the fact that some people have this kind of are inclinational, and these are the dangerous ones, and they seem to be in the majority. For instance, her hand line. Hand lines are, I quote, her fate's furrows. The changeless salt hatchings of her identity. And this appears shortly afterwards as the coded tenacity of protein. There seems to be in Pynchon's work then the feeling, and of course it can't possibly be undisclosed until we know more about the genetic structure, even more than we know now. But certainly it's a motivational urge which is available. That is, he feels that the biological urge to enter this, what he calls, slick labyrinth may be involved. Maybe. But he's very clear also that she is involved in the history of power structures. I quote, which is right at the very end of the book. Power, omniscience, implacable malice, attributes of what they'd thought historical principles, to be historical principles, a zeitgeist, are carried over to the now human enemy. So much that, by 1795, it was even suggested that Tristero had staged the entire French Revolution just for the excuse to issue the proclamation of the Ninth Frimaire, which ratified the end of the Turn and Taxis postal monopoly in France and the lowlands. That is real mania, of course. At last, Oedipa discovers, 13 pages from the end of the novel, what has been clear to the reader for some time, that the anarchist underground, the tank theatre, the shops, offices, factories, the lot of San Narciso, the Tristera, and the waste systems are parts of a single organisation. Or at least a part of, there are manifestations of a single urge to manifest to organisation. I quote, every access route to the Tristero could be traced also back to the Inverarity estate, which is what she's inherited. So, research into her legacy has reduced her to four symmetrical alternatives as solutions, which are these. One, that there is a secret network of American truly communicative underground. I quote, while reserving their lies, recitations of routine, arid betrayals of spiritual poverty for the official government delivery system, a real alternative to the exitlessness, to the absence of surprise to life. Second, that she is in hallucination. Third, that, I quote, a labyrinthine plot had been mounted against her. Four, is it? No. Yes, it is four. That she is that she is fantasying some such plot and is therefore, as she says, a nut. The distinction between hallucinating and fantasying, you see, the fantasy implies the imaginative thing at work. Well, she decides to hope that she's mentally ill as a way out. And this increases her paranoid sense of isolation and conspiracy. She's trapped. Her informants keep pumping information into her system. Until finally, America seems to be the last container of Tristera. Oedipa has reached saturation point in a saturated society. Or, to use the electronic metaphors that Pynchon uses, she's become part of the circuitry. Or, in terms of the second law of thermodynamics, equilibrium has been set up between the internal and external systems, the human and the environment. The temperatures are equalizing, that is, the stabilization of chaos. I quote, she had dedicated herself weeks ago to making sense of what Inverarity had left behind, never suspecting that the legacy was America. Might Oedipa Mars yet be his heiress? It's a kind of like TV serial question. Now, Inverarity's belief then in keeping America possessively developing and accumulating has passed to her. And the growth rates, as they're called, are now ending. The plot she inherits is too large, too elaborate for Inverarity and for her. All the possibilities cannot be predicted or manipulated. And at one point at the end of the book, she's standing between the rails of the steel rails of a railroad track, and she envisages another one of her images of communication, which comes to her, flashes into her sensibility. She envisages the map of communications as they used to be in America, and all those who were supposed to have been inheritors like her of what America originally was supposed to stand for, and yet have never inherited, duped by organizational power, and like her, awaiting what she can only call the word. Would the legacy at last be spread among those nameless? Now, Oedipa knows that such an action would if she was to take part in it, would outlaw her. Might even, I quote, hound her someday as far as joining Tristero itself, if it existed, in its twilight, its aloofness, its waiting. And you see, by Tristero, she's still trying to mean, I quote, another set of possibilities to replace those that have conditioned the land to accept any in San Narciso among its most tender flesh, without a reflex or a cry. For it was now like walking among matrices of a great digital computer, the zeros and ones twinned above, hanging like balanced mobiles right and left, ahead, sick, maybe endless. Behind the hieroglyphic streets, there would either be a transcendental meaning or only the earth. It's the songs of Miles, Dean, Serge, and Leonard sang, which were either some fraction of the truth's numinous beauty or only a power spectrum. Pynchon, you see, has done here a mobile of the total situation. The plot of how it is without final definition by metaphor. His plots are all mobiles. That is, there are circumscriptions which continually change. You know what a mobile looks like. I quote, another mode of meaning behind the obvious or none. Either Oedipus in the arbitrary ecstasy of true paranoia or a real Tristero. For there either was some Tristero beyond the appearance of the legacy of America or it was just America. I quoted it before. Is there anything then that could be a sign of a resistance movement which was not part of the waste operations? Is all change doomed to the entropic operations of the history of Tristero? Is America simply an illusion of alternative? What exactly could bring about the end of disinheritance? Now, what are the answers? And there aren't any in the book. The novel poses the situation of these possibilities. For Oedipus, it's too late. And she has moved towards total assimilation by the waste. She becomes a grotesque of the printed circuit. Change and revolution can't emerge from enlisting in entropically repetitive systems, whose action has to be discovered, ironically, by totally involving yourself in detective work about them. Or who wants to be part of the assimilated plot of tragedy, for instance? The conspiracy that there is meaning, and it's controlled by a priesthood, a mafia, a cartel, or a communication system, is what the book is asking. So The Crying of Lot 49, I think, is a novel of extreme awareness of how wary you must be of ideologies, systems, great metaphors, selective designs, epic plots of all, solutions, explanatory authoritarian structures, exclusive points of view. Now, both this novel and V set up mobiles of forces and decisions which parody the conventional detective linear plot in order to correct it, and also to correct the idea that at the end of a linear structure you have a sense of completion and the revelation of meaning. The heroine, as her name suggests, goes back into her desire to be her father's daughter, but not without experienced incipient madness, before finally yielding to the deadly past. An example of science and philosophy in the novel prevents it from having the aggressive pretensions of the usual fictional alibis with systems. In fact, I think it could serve as a very good example of the French structuralist writer Roland Barthes in his book called Writing Degree Zero, which is a little paperback edition, which you ought to have a look if I might suggest. Roland Barthes is B-A-R-T-H-E-S. It's called Writing Degree Zero. And there he says, the novel is a death. It transforms life into destiny. It is society which imposes the novel. Then he goes on to say, the writer becomes honest when he, I quote, rediscovers the primary conditions of classical art, instrumentality. But this time, I quote, an instrument no longer as the service of an ideology. That is what he calls writing at degree zero. And I quote, finally, this morning, a few lines from Roland Barthes. Tragedy is merely a means of recovering human misery, of subsuming and thereby justifying it in the form of a necessity, a wisdom, or a purification. To refuse this recuperation and to investigate the techniques of not treacherously succumbing to it, nothing is more insidious than tragedy, is today necessary enterprise. Sorry I kept you a little late.